is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Lake County E911 is offering police and fire departments more information that they can use in determining the kinds of calls that their crews handle based on the information that the dispatchers get. I talked with Mark Swiderski, the county's E911 director, about this new service.
You know, I think one of the best opportunities that the program provides is several different reports that we can generate. One of them, which was talked about in the article in the Post Tribune, is some real-time reports as far as how long it takes on average throughout the communities for a certain type of incident to occur. That's one part of it, and that'll help probably more the detectives and things like that. One of the other reports that's, I think, going to be very beneficial is they can run a report based per hour how many calls they receive for each department, and I think that'll help for staffing issues for everyone, the police departments, the fire departments, as well as our own entity here. I think all in all, analytics are a huge importance to the communities, and they need to use the information that's been given to them to the best of their abilities.
When did the idea of being able to come up with this real-time reporting system start? Is this something that's been going on for some time, or is this something that once the new E911 system got established and you had the mechanism in place with the high-tech that you have now to work with, compared to the way that the dispatchers had been handled across Lake County, is that something that came up just in discovery or had been in the planning works for a while?
Our deputy director, Jack Allendorf, he was looking through some of the reports, and he came to me a couple months ago and said, look at this one report that I can run. And he showed me basically that, you know, within so many minutes, within so many hours, a certain type of incident occurs throughout the county. And I thought that was really an interesting dynamic to everything, and I brought it up at one of the commission meetings. Quite frankly, I don't know if the departments were already using it or not. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, and as the article stated, one of the important things is the reports that we ran there specify what the dispatcher thought the call was going to be, not maybe what the outcome was. They're only given certain type of information. A good example would be somebody might say that they were just robbed. We put it in as a robbery, come to find out their house was burglarized. Mm-hmm. So that part, that particular report is going to give them information as far as what the dispatchers received. Now, one of the important things that I think that's going to be different now is that when each person was in their own centers is once we get everyone trained to the proper level and everyone understanding what type of calls or what type of incidents, it'll straight across the board for each department. The dispatchers believe that when given this type of information, that's the type of call that they'll generate. That's the type of nature that they'll use.
Now that you know what you have received so far, what kinds of fine-tuning can you do to the information that you get from the Spillman system that you're able to put out these reports and that in turn will benefit everybody?
You know, I think one of the main things, honestly, and I said it a little while ago, is training, you know, for our people here as well as, you know, out on the streets, is they understand what type of incidents create what type of nature codes. When you're at your own agency, it may have been one way, but we need to keep things uniform here so that everyone gets the same type of information and none of that information skewed.
How many calls have you determined, at least going into the end of 2016 as we start a new year, have you determined that the dispatchers received here in Lake County, and how does that get broken down as to how often the calls seem to come into the center?
Just last year, we ran a report. The end of last year, beginning of this year, and ultimately, calls received and calls made from our 911 center were over 824,000 for the year. That equated to 2,260 a day, which made it 95 calls an hour, equated to 1.5 calls a minute.
That's amazing. Although I guess the size of Lake County probably determines why we get so many calls, but it is very, very difficult to fathom how many phone calls come into the 911 system that then have to get funneled back out to the emergency agencies out there in Northwest Indiana.
Yes, sir. It's with 460,000 residents, all in all, it's a great task for the dispatchers. They're very dedicated and very professional, and ultimately, we're just trying to serve the community the best we can.
That's Mark Swiderski, who is the Lake County E911 director. At the State House, lawmakers are considering two bills that would address the Hoosier State's outdated water infrastructure, from the facilities that sanitize our refuse to the pipes that deliver our drinking water. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen talked with the Northwest Indiana legislator, and he reports that the bills could be the first steps, but they don't allocate any money.
Some of Indiana's water infrastructure is over a century old.
When we're talking about wooden pipes yet, when we're talking about pipes that have been in the ground since the 1800s.
That's State Senator Ed Charbonneau.
When we're talking about the fact that the best of the best utilities are on a replacement cycle of something like 140 years.
Charbonneau's authored two bills addressing water infrastructure this year. He's been working on the issue since 2012, writing legislation, chairing study committees.
Everybody thinks we have all the water we need. Everybody thinks we don't have any problems, and you don't see the problems. But ultimately, we have a bigger problem below the surface of the ground that you don't see than the one that we're addressing now with the road funding.
The legislature is considering a massive infrastructure spending package this year to fix the roads. None of that money would go towards improving water infrastructure. Instead, Charbonneau's bills address the problem incrementally.
I didn't want us, as we started drafting legislation, to make it sound like this was Indianapolis telling the rest of the state what they're going to do with their water. If that was the approach, it was doomed to failure.
So one of Charbonneau's bills would establish a fund to help communities finance water infrastructure projects, although it doesn't actually appropriate any money for that fund. Think of it as a pot for money that will hopefully come in the future. The other bill makes the Indiana Finance Authority, the IFA, the lead agency on water infrastructure issues. That might seem strange. There's over a dozen state agencies that deal with water. But the IFA already uses state and federal money to provide low-interest loans to communities. So the idea is to let it manage that pot for money once there's a plan to put money in it. Director of Environmental Programs at IFA, Jim McGough, says the agency has been studying the state's water infrastructure since 2014. It found as much as 75% of Indiana's population is using water utilities in urgent need of replacement or repair. The estimated cost? Over $2 billion immediately, and then an additional $815 million long-term. If or when state money is allocated for updates, McGough says the state also identified two starting priorities.
One of those being lead line replacement, and a second being the very old service lines, some in excess of 100 years old.
There have been a lot of other reports that underline urgency. One says every single county in the state, all 92, have significant needs and projects a $7 billion funding gap over the next 20 years. Another, this one conducted by an economic consultancy group in Michigan, found that nearly a quarter of Indiana businesses are dependent on water, more than any other state in the nation. Charbonneau says incremental was the way to start addressing the water infrastructure issue, but he says the state will need to allocate some money at some point.
We're at the point where we're looking at a $2.3 billion immediate need. And you can't address $2.3 billion incrementally, or you'll be incrementaling from now until 2090 or something like that. So the rubber's going to have to meet the road here.
Charbonneau says he'd like the legislature to consider a spending package on water infrastructure like the one currently being considered for roads by 2019, if not sooner. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
A Chicago-based interior designer is the third finalist for this year's John S. and James L. Knight Foundation Cities Challenge Grant Competition for the city of Gary. The foundation's goal is to make the 26 communities where Knight invests, including Gary, more vibrant places in which to live and work. Dana Crawford works for Smith Group JJR on what is being called the In Love in Gary, Indiana project. The goal is to create some downtown space into what she says can be best described as a wedding destination.
One of my teammates, who is a landscape architect, Mark Woodhurst, actually got to do a driving tour of Gary with Jack Eskin of the City of Gary Planning and Redevelopment Department. So they had a nice conversation about what potential lots would be good based on kind of what's in the pipeline for downtown Gary. So our proposed site is on the 500 block of Broadway in Gary. It's on the east side. There's a large mural of the Jackson 5 overlooking it. I don't know if you're familiar with that particular lot, but so it's just kind of from what we gather from him and our own research, or from him being Jack, and our own research, it seems like there's a lot of cool things currently happening and about to be happening on that stretch of Broadway there.
It sounds like it is an interesting spot to be able to set something up here. It will attract a lot of attention, and you're not in that area, not terribly far away from locations downtown, like City Hall, as well as the Genesis Convention Center, and even not all that far away to the U.S. Steel Yard. So we're talking, you know, the baseball diamonds and convention sites and things like that. So you're liable to get a lot of side business for sure if there are events happening in the area too, shouldn't it?
That's what we're hoping for. We've designed the site and the amenities on the site specifically to cater to weddings. So, you know, we've got a non-denominational altar area where you can have a ceremony, and we've got a small, very basic but highly functional building that would have, you know, restrooms for people to use and a little concession bar window area, and then, you know, coming off the back would be a bridal suite so that the bride could change on site there. But the thing, you know, the thing that we really wanted to be mindful of is, how do we make this dual function? How does it support all kinds of community events in Gary? So we have, in the front of the lot of our proposed design is different stations for food trucks to pull up. And so, you know, you can do a food truck catered wedding, which is very, you know, unique and hip and kind of out there. But you could also just do, you know, a pop-up ice skating rink in the wintertime, and food trucks can come and sell hot chocolate to residents. Or, you know, we've heard of different opportunities such as a pop-up retail event happening along Broadway, and then you've got, you know, sort of this hub where, as unglamorous as it is, you know, clean restrooms and some picnic tables under a shaded awning are a nice foundation for any kind of event that you'd want to hold.
That's interesting. Now, if things go well, if you get the grant from the Knight Foundation to be able to continue on with this, what kind of timetable do you have kind of set forth right now to be able to get this project going?
The grant proposal was, it's an 18-month time period, and the project has to be complete. It's a fairly simple construction, both on the building side and the landscape side. Our proposed design would be wrapped up around September, you know, give or take some flexibility on that, and then we would begin construction in October and have hopefully everything wrapped up on the building side by May or June of 2018, so that, you know, we could really start to get events in there starting July 2018 through the winter. In those last few months, we could hopefully have a few weddings and a fall event and a winter event, so that it really became an all-season space.
That is Dana Crawford with Smith Group JJR, which is working on a project that became the third finalist for this year's Knight Foundation Cities Challenge program in the city of Gary. The foundation will make public the 2017 grant award winners this coming spring. Next week is Shakespeare Week at Valparaiso University. That's a very, very good opportunity to catch some great plays performed by some very, very experienced and professional actors who come over from London to be able to show their works as they have interpreted them from the Bard of Stratford-upon-Avon. With us to talk about the event coming up, we have Dean Peter Canellos, who is, of course, with Christ College. That's the Honors College at Valparaiso University. Dean, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Give us a little history, if you will, please, about how Shakespeare Week got started at Valparaiso University.
Well, this is the fourth annual Shakespeare Week at Valparaiso University, and it started 4 years ago, not surprisingly, with my arrival. My academic background is in Shakespeare. I'm a Shakespearean scholar by training. And so when I came to the university and took the position of dean here, I was looking for opportunities to share my own background and experience with the university in a way that would give something to the community here, both our on-campus and our Valparaiso and region community. So having connections with various acting companies that make their way across the United States and perform, I tapped into a group called Actors from the London Stage based out of Notre Dame. and invited them to come spend a week-long residency with us that first year. They spent a week here meeting with our students, running workshops, et cetera, and then at the end of the residency performing three performances of a play that they were touring around. So it was such a success the first time around, we decided to keep it running, and now we're on year four.
Now, actors from the London stage, obviously, they do a lot of their performances in London. Do many of them come over from England to take part in this, even though you say it's a program that's based out of University of Notre Dame?
That's right. So this particular program brings annually five actors who have all been affiliated with the Royal Shakespeare Company at one point or another and who are classically trained actors in the U.K., and it brings over a kind of core group of five actors to tour together across the United States, and they visit primarily college campuses, and they perform one play in the fall and one play in the spring. So they sort of switch it up at the midpoint. So this group is a kind of group that's composed specifically for performing in the United States.
So I suppose it would be different than, say, if you got a group of actors that perform, say, at the Stratford Festival in Canada. They're more accustomed to doing Shakespeare, so to speak, the Canadian way, I suppose.
That's right. There are different approaches to Shakespeare in different countries, and a lot of it has to do with the performance history in that particular country and the training that the actors get. These actors who come to us, again, are classically trained in the British style of performing Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And you see the difference when they perform. The British style tends to focus more on language than action, and more on the interpretation of Shakespeare's lines and verse rather than on using staging and effects to convey the meaning of the plays. So what we find with this group of actors, it's really fascinating, because there's only five actors, yet they're performing plays of Shakespeare in their entirety, the actors have to duplicate roles, and so they'll be playing several different roles during the course of the play, and they handle this very deftly. They change from character to character, sometimes right in front of your eyes, and they can do this because they're masters of language, so that even though you see the same person, because they inhabit the roles verbally and vocally, so thoroughly, they transform from one character to another.
So I guess it's obviously much different because of the interpretation they make on the works themselves. You don't have to worry about the fact that, okay, you have only about five people up. We have five people on the stage, but you have different characters, so you don't have to worry about costume changes and the like to deal with in that, do you?
Well, it's fascinating. In fact, they change costumes, but often very subtly, because this particular company, their style is to keep all five actors on the stage throughout the whole performance, so you mm-hmm. never lose sight of them. But often what they'll do is if they're not on in a particular scene, they'll usually sit on the side, sometimes even playing instruments that accompany the scene. But when they're on stage and they're in character, if they transform to another character, oftentimes they'll do it just with they'll put a hat on or pick up a cane that indicates that they're an older character or that. So the transformation is subtle. It's done sometimes through costumes and props, and sometimes just through the way they bodily inhabit the character. You know, they'll go from being a 13-year-old young woman to being a knight, and their whole bodily composure changes in those moments as well.
That's interesting. We're talking with Honors College Dean Peter Canellos from Valparaiso University. Christ College, the Honors College, is once again, along with the departments of theater and English, on the VU campus, getting ready for Shakespeare Week, which is coming up this next week. Dean Canellos, tell us a little more of the particulars about the group of actors coming in and what they're going to be doing as they're here this next week.
So troop of actors coming in, as I said, there'll be five actors, three men and two women, and they come to our campus on Monday, which is February 13th, and they spend the week with our students and with some members of our faculty in many different capacities. So, for example, on the first evening they're here, they'll meet with our theater students and run a kind of colloquium, just talking about what it's like to live as an actor, and specifically to live as an actor who focuses on the stage and that. And then throughout the week, they'll visit various classes, and they will spend time in those classes doing a variety of things. And it's fascinating because they will, they say that they can bring Shakespeare to any subject and that we teach, and they do. So we, of course, will have them visit classes, you know, having to do a theater in English, and they'll maybe perform a scene that the students are studying. But they've also gone to classes in our law school. And in our science departments in that, and brought acting, brought Shakespeare to bear upon the subjects at hand. A quick example of that is last year we had a professor who was teaching a course on the writings of St. Paul, and he invited the actors, and he said, to help us understand the writings of St. Paul. And what they did was they took part of an epistle of St. Paul, a letter, and they dramatize it. They said, what happens if you take this letter that is essentially a conversation between the person writing it and the person receiving it, and you turn it into a dramatic scene and you enact it? And it was a sort of fascinating addition to what the students were studying. And it's amazing. You know, actors have many, many talents, and they have, you know, deep creativity. And, you know, we try to take advantage of that.
Well, this fits in very well with what I guess you can consider in Christ College is this interdisciplinary spirit. You've gotten, of course, the cooperation of two separate departments in helping bring all this together anyway. But then, as you say, when the actors from the London stage make their visits to other departments, to other classes, they're able to show the adaptation of what you can take from the classics, and in particular from Shakespeare, and turn it into something that can be used in some other entirely different discipline. It's very interesting. The members of the Valparaiso area community get take a chance to take advantage of some of these performances?
Absolutely. So we have several events throughout the week that members of the community are invited to. On Tuesday evening at 6:30 on February 14th in our Christopher Center, which is the room right adjacent to our library, we're going to be screening, and the actors should be there for conversation afterwards, a film called Private Romeo that was made in 2011 and directed by Alan Brown. And we're going to talk about how Shakespeare is adapted from the stage to screen and use that film as an example. On Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. in the Christ College refectory here in Muller Hall, we have a group of young actors from Chicago Street Theater who are going to be performing The Tempest. And that's open to the public as well. Both of those events are free. And then Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings at 7 p.m. in the University Theater, these actors, the actors from the London stage, will be performing Romeo and Juliet, and that is open to the public as well.
It's a great opportunity for folks to see Shakespeare if they haven't seen it lately. Maybe they, as we mentioned, may have gone to visit and seen Shakespeare being performed in New York, in Chicago, perhaps even at the Stratford Festival in Ontario. But here's a chance to see it right here at Valparaiso University this next week during Shakespeare Week. If anybody would like more information, Dean Canellos, how can they find out more?
Sure. They can go on the Valparaiso University website, which is valpo.edu, and there is a page there on Shakespeare Week, or they can access it through the Christ College website, and that's valpo.edu/Christ College. And we have information about all the events available on either of those locations.
Peter Canellos is the dean of Christ College, which is the Honors College at Valparaiso University. And Christ College, along with the Departments of Theater and English, are once again co-sponsoring Shakespeare Week on the campus in Valparaiso this next week. Dean Canellos, thank you very much for being with us. The best of luck to you and to the actors as well, too, as they come in and spend their time visiting here in Northwest Indiana. We know that some certainly enjoy it, because otherwise I'm sure they wouldn't be back to perform again at Valparaiso University College, Valparaiso University, if it weren't for the fact that they like working with you folks there at Christ College.
Well, thank you for the time this morning, and we hope to see all of your listeners at any and all of our events this coming Shakespeare Week.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Community activist and IU Northwest Labor Studies Professor Emeritus Ruth Needleman joined us in the studio just before the end of the year to talk about her interest in the community and its people. And Needleman says her journey began with a rich experience in education and social service, leading to IU Northwest in Gary, and then, after retirement from the faculty, an almost full-time devotion to some of the community issues.
When I was teaching Latin American Studies and Latin American Literature out at the University of California, I took a sabbatical and went to Chile when Salvador Allende was president. And I did a lot of work and wrote a book on the people behind the right-wing work stoppage in October, which was right before, a year before the coup. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back, I felt like I had to do social justice work, that the military coup in Chile killed my friends, including Americans. It killed people I had worked with there, and it tore my heart out. And so I went to work with the United Farm Workers Union and Cesar Chavez. And from there, it's been organizing, organizing, mm-hmm. organizing. And I came here for the job of a lifetime. I got to teach adult workers here for 30 years.
Now, you went into, basically, you became a professor of labor studies. For folks who are not familiar with that particular discipline, what does that involve?
This was one of the few programs in the country where we taught credit classes for degrees, and we also did non-credit training.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you could get a Bachelor of Science degree in labor studies, and I taught labor history, I taught labor law, I taught collective bargaining, comparative labor movements. You had to step up and be able to teach many things. But I also taught grievance handling, and I taught arbitration. And it was wonderful because there are no better students than adult students. Mm-hmm. They come to you saying they know nothing, but they know so much more than traditional undergraduates. I now teach a course at the School of the Art Institute on social movements, but my students are kids. And they don't know anything, and they don't know that they don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's and sometimes that's dangerous in its own right, too.
That's
right.
I prefer the workers, but these kids are fun.
Now, you're talking about having a chance to be able to educate adults. In this case, we're talking about steel workers. That's how you, I guess, was Swing Shift College.
Swing
is what
Shift.
You and a colleague created at the IU Northwest.
Well, no, it was me, really, that created it. But I worked very closely with the steel mills. And with the university to put together a customized program for workers who work swing shifts, also who have been out of school for decades and whose prior school experience was probably lousy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw building confidence. We saw giving people an understanding of their own lives as a core necessity for them to be able to learn new things. And we graduated many, many people, well over, 120, but there were groups that went through together, and the peer experience created a great learning community.
Was this a kind of experience that probably is a predecessor to what we see today with Ivy Tech Community College, where we have so much adult learning?
No.
Okay.
No, because what we were doing was based in part on the thinking of a man named Paulo Freire, who was a philosopher and an educator in Brazil, who developed a system of learning that was student-based, student-centered, problem-centered. And so our classes always began with what people already knew, so that what they were learning would have a place to fit into their worldview. And we gave people a lot of literacy education. We helped people deal with difficult topics from math to geology to geography. And we did it swing shifted. Plus, we videotaped. So at the beginning, people could take home a videotape. Then they could take home a DVD. And finally, it was streamed. So if they worked a double, or they worked a 10-hour day or a 12-hour day, they could watch the class. And our students were some of the smartest students on campus. And it was a community experience that really showed how intelligent workers are if they are supported in a peer group, and if their knowledge is taken seriously and if it is valued.
Is there anything that is like it today that we see in the system, either with Indiana University Northwest or Purdue Northwest or any other university?
Not that I know of. And that's why it was so important, because it really broke new ground in educational theory and practice.
Now, how did you take this opportunity to be able to teach labor studies and all the other things there at IU Northwest and put that information together by being a resident of the region and seeing and hearing as much as you did that got you so involved as being a community activist locally, because you were, of course, an activist in the past as well through the years. But what brought you to focus in on Northwest Indiana?
Well, my students. Right? We were talking about their lives. We were talking about their experience. My first course in Swing Shift was called SOS, The State of Steel. And part of what we did was we designed that class with steelworkers so that it would be attractive to steelworkers. We took people on field trips. I had them write essays on, if I were the CEO of Bethlehem, what would I do differently? Mm-hmm. But most of all, you know, I wrote a book on black steelworkers in Northwest Indiana. And so I did a ton of research on the whole history of workers and communities, working class communities in Northwest Indiana. And it kept me pretty busy, but once I retired, I became involved with the Northwest Indiana Federation of Interfaith Organizations that has been fighting for local hiring, for development projects that benefit the community, and especially dealing with the very large number of African Americans in Gary who have been unemployed long term, who basically have given up hope. And if you stick them into a training program, they'll fail because they don't have the kind of support systems we had at Swing Shift College. And so I've been involved fighting many of the development projects that have taken place. I picketed my own university a year ago because they built a building and didn't hire anybody from Gary. Mm-hmm. And they had promised that they would. And so I was involved in the GEO struggle to prevent an immigrant prison run by one of the worst, disgusting companies in the country from taking root here. It would have harmed even further. And one of the things that city council women, both Reagan Hatcher and Levita Sparkwaites, talked about at the last city council meeting was that a lot of people look at Gary and said, we have to take anything we can get because we're worthless. And we believe that Gary is not worthless. Gary has an incredible lakefront. It has national park areas. It has dunes. It has marshes. And it has a resourceful, large population of people who can learn, will learn, and can work. And so we want development projects that actually enhance our city. And that doesn't mean an industrial park where Ivanhoe used to be. And it certainly doesn't mean, as the Jupiter Project suggests, another landfill that will take in all the demolition that's being done, which includes lead pipes, it includes lead paint, and of course many other toxic contaminants.
What have you and your colleagues and your fellow activists have thought about with all of this open space that is that can be developed here within the city of Gary, what that should go to? It's not all of it certainly would be appropriate with the neighborhoods, the old neighborhoods that are being narrowed down because they have all the open spaces for all the abandoned buildings and the like. But what, there's got to be some use for this land here. What are you folks thinking about to put this land to good use as opposed to being more industrial park space?
Well, there's a number of things. One is, of course, to rebuild the communities themselves and provide parks and resources, libraries for the communities that were there that have been devastated and could be brought back using, for example, TIF funds. But the TIF that was passed last week at the Common Council will make it possible to build a road in front of the industrial park to enable or facilitate trucks coming in and out, To me, that's further pollution of what was once a livable, warm community. So one is to rebuild communities, but also there is a lot of work we could be doing. There's a lot of advanced manufacturing, small companies that could be set up here, and I think we have not even addressed the issue of cooperatives. And cooperatives have been a source of employment and even prosperity for a lot of workers throughout the world, including in this country, in Ohio and in Mississippi. They have cooperatives that provide jobs, provide training, and also enhance the community. You can't build a community next to a toxic landfill. And this toxic landfill, which they're going to claim is not toxic, is also, after it's all filled up and they want maximum stuffing it in, will be sold back to the city, which means the liability is sold back to the city. And they're talking about using it for public or recreational use. Go play in our lead, or let's bring West Calumet over to Gary and have yet another crisis. And it's already reported that our lead in our water is almost the same as East Chicago.
Mm-hmm. In fact, let's talk about East Chicago. You had a chance to talk with city officials, be present for meetings. We know very well about the documented problems in the city of East Chicago, and in particular in the Calumet neighborhood. And we've reported quite a bit of it here on Lakeshore Public Radio during the last few months. But you had a chance to sit in on a meeting with the mayor. Tell us about that conversation and how you hope things will, with everything that has been discussed, at least in recent weeks, can be leading, I guess, to hopefully some solutions, or at least pushing some solutions along.
This is a tragedy that's immeasurable. But one of the bright sides, and I think it became clear at the meeting, and the mayor has agreed to meet with the citizens of West Calumet every Friday morning from now to eternity, mm-hmm, until this is resolved, is that local people are speaking for themselves. It was a joy to be at this meeting. I didn't say a word because the people who live there, including the leadership, the council in the old age home, Nicosia, mm-hmm, which was one of the worst because the owners of Nicosia would not allow people on site to test. And it turns out that it was one of the most contaminated buildings in the whole area. And now they can't even do testing in that building because it's too polluted and contaminated. But there were the leader, Mrs. Lowe from the Nicosia building, spoke out eloquently about their problems and their needs, why seniors are not getting into cars and driving over for blood testing at the public health department. These are people who have been battered, abused, threatened, and some immobile. And so you have to really make special arrangements. Also, Maritza Lopez, who has been chairing a CAG, which is a community action group with EPA, spoke, as well as Akeisha Daniels. And these are people from the neighborhood. And the mayor said, "You were right, I was wrong." That is almost never heard in this country. And so he has now written a letter to the governor, to be, and the governor right now, saying this needs to be declared an emergency because we don't have the funds to deal with it. And everybody knew that was the case from the beginning because this goes back to the 70s. And they already knew by 1984. Visclosky wrote a letter in, I think it was 84, 86, saying this is a catastrophe. This is toxic contamination. This will be a disaster. And nothing was done. So now there's some movement. It doesn't change the disaster. The people who live there have nowhere else to go. Zones 2 and 3, we have some people who have owned homes for 50-plus years. And their home absolutely dropped catastrophically in value the day they discovered the lead. Mm-hmm. And so now, if they were to sell their houses, they would get nothing. So they are demanding to be reimbursed the real value of their house prior to the lead crisis. And if they can clean up some of those areas, fine. But every time they dig, they send lead into the air because the lead has all leached upwards. And they have signs all over the area, don't play in the dirt. Well, where are the kids going to go? They have to walk through the dirt to get to the school bus.
Do you think that you'll have an opportunity or you'll take the opportunity if you get to go to these Friday meetings with the mayor and the folks in the neighborhoods that are affected and hear what the latest is and find out more and what Mayor Copeland is able to be able to do?
I am planning to attend the meetings, and I have tried to be as supportive as possible. Anyone who goes to my Facebook page can see photos of these people speaking out from day one, demanding to be heard. Now the mayor is hearing them. But there were many efforts to divide, to stall, to discourage any citizenship engagement. Mm-hmm. And the only way they will get their needs met is if they are speaking for themselves.
That is community activist Ruth Needleman, who, by the way, will be back with us here in the studio next week. Matthew Sweet is set to release a new album, and he talks with Kyle Meredith today on The Speed of Sound.
The Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith.
It's been 6 years since power pop god Matthew Sweet released an album of original music. But brothers and sisters, I am here to tell you that there is a light at the end of that tunnel. Sweet has completed what is essentially a double album, though being released as a single disc and a separate bonus collection, but due out this year. So I thought I'd give him a call to get the details. I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
Your master is freezing. You're keeping you locked in a cage of your own.
You've sort of like done the soft announce in other interviews that new music is on the way, but the last time, the last Originals album was 2011's Modern Art, and there was the Volume 3 of Under the Covers. But, you know, I'm going to ask the basic generic question of, like, what have you been doing the last few years?
It's so weird that much time passed. It kind of blows my mind. I think a lot, you know, 2 or 3 years of it can be attributed to just my wife and I moving. You know, after 20 years in Los Angeles, we moved to Nebraska. I'm sure we probably talked about that before. But, you know, that kind of took, you know, about a year. First of all, not even a year into it, my mother died. So that kind of made everything change in just a odd, not definable way, you know. But you go through what you go through. And I never had a parent, you know, die before her. So I think that kind of froze me. It made me get going slowly on the Kickstarter because it just kind of knocked me out a little bit and I just didn't really know how to start working, you know. By the time I started the record, it was a couple of years ago, after I'd sold it on Kickstarter. It probably didn't start it for like 9 months. And then I've just been working on it, and because I did multiple batches of songs, I really wanted to have a lot of songs to pull from. That took me a little longer too. But the result, I think, is really, really good, and I'm really excited about it.
I can't understand you.
So, you know, as far as the songs themselves, I mean, is there, I don't know, a mood or a concept or even a theme to these songs, especially having come, you know, in the wake of something as tragic as losing your parents?
Well, I think that they're, you know, losing my mother is in there. Being excited with kind of a clean slate is in there. Pondering the universe is in there. You know, a lot of topics probably I would normally attack, but I think it's hard for me to say what it overall seems like. It's got a pretty widely varied kinds of things on it, which is one of the reasons I did so many groups of songs, is to just try to make sure I had really good things of all kinds, you know.
Because you need to get back in the arms of a good friend. I need to
are so closely associated, not just with a specific instrument, the guitar, but even that style of pop rock that, you know, is kind of, you know, people have kind of stamped you with your entire career.
Yeah.
And have you ever thought that painted you into a corner? Because you do mess with other sounds, you know, different versions of rock.
Yeah.
Paint you into a corner, or and does it make it hard to paint outside of those lines because of that label?
I think if I were to absorb those kind of ideas and think about it, maybe it would influence me to some degree, but it's just not how I do it, you know. So once I'm making songs, I'm just not really thinking about where I come from, you know what I mean? I just do kind of whatever. But I mean, obviously over the years I found out people say power pop, and that's fine with me. I'm amazed to still exist, you know. I'll wait till 3,000 to get in the Rock Hall of Fame. but I probably will. It won't exist, I suppose. Rock? What was that? But no, I don't. I don't really feel restricted. And it was kind of fun being here because I did a couple songs that I did sort of early on, actually, in the record. I did one where Gary Louris did some vocals on it and played some guitar on it. And then a second one that he played on some. And they were kind of country rock, you know?
Yep.
But then there's like kind of a acid-y surf song on it, so there's like something that's weird, sort of surf, and then there's this kind of baroque ballady trippy stuff that, you know, a couple of songs I just love how they turned out so much, and part of it is from his musicianship, but Rod Argent played on grand piano on two songs.
Oh, that's awesome.
And both those songs are just elevated by his talent. I don't know. I'm curious for people to hear it. It'll be interesting to see what they like. You know, I actually gave all the roughs to more people than I usually do around me. And everybody made, like, lists, tried to, you know, prioritize what they liked the most. And the first kind of 15 or so of those were just everyone picked them. You know, so I feel pretty good about, you know, the main core of songs.
That's Matthew Sweet, and we'll all be looking forward to the new album later this year. For more of my interviews, head to Facebook and Twitter at Kyle Meredith. Thanks to Brad Yost for co-producing and editing this episode. And from the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
The sunshine. Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith can be heard on Tuesdays and Thursdays here on Regionally Speaking. Podcasts can be found on the program's A through Z tab of our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. On this week's Shelf Discovery, Kristen battles more bad guys with shadowy hero Evan Smoke in Greg Hurwitz's The Nowhere Man.
Don't be fooled by expensive furnishings, because this week's Discovery fights to escape a luxurious prison. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Shelf Discovery. I'm your host, Kristen Dreyer Kramer, from nightsandweekends.com. In Orphan X, author Greg Hurwitz introduced readers to a shadowy new literary action hero who fights for those who can't fight for themselves. And in the follow-up, The Nowhere Man, the man formerly known as Orphan X finds himself battling both his past and an over-the-top new enemy. The story continues to follow Evan Smoke, a mysterious crime fighter known as the Nowhere Man. Trained from his youth as a black ops assassin, he's broken away from the system that wanted to terminate him and still hunts him to help the helpless, one case at a time. When Evan is captured and taken to a remote and heavily fortified location, he finds himself in a strange position. This time, he's the one who needs help. But his clients need him, and he'll do whatever it takes to get to them. While Orphan X was a high-speed thriller following Evan on a series of wild adventures, The Nowhere Man is a very different novel. Evan is trapped in an enormous chateau that's designed to keep him from escaping.
So while there's still plenty of fighting, there's more tension and suspense than breakneck action. The story also spends a lot of time on flashbacks, recapping parts of Evan's history that also played a large part in the first novel. Some of the twists, too, seem a little too convenient and a little too hard to believe, making the story weaker than the original. Still, there are plenty of touches here to hold readers' attention. Evan's captor is the kind of villain you'd find in a James Bond movie. He's so flamboyantly sinister that he adds a wild playfulness to the story. And while it may not live up to the action of the first installment, this outrageous villain and his thugs keep it entertaining. But is it worth planning your escape with this cunning captive? On a scale of buy it, borrow it, or don't bother, I say borrow it. The Nowhere Man doesn't quite keep up with the gripping action and thoughtful drama of Orphan X, but it's still a tense and fascinating read. And once you finish, you'll be eager to see what's next for this shadowy hero. Well, it looks like we've come to the last page of this week's Shelf Discovery. The Nowhere Man by Greg Hurwitz is 342 claustrophobic pages long and is available from Minotaur Books. For more information, along with show archives and even more reviews, visit shelfdiscovery.org and nightsandweekends.com. And feel free to send any questions, comments, or recommendations my way at books@shelfdiscovery.org. Until next time, wherever the week may take you, don't forget to bring a book.
Shelf Discovery can be heard on Thursdays here on Regionally Speaking as Kristen Dreyer Kramer offers listeners a brief look inside the pages of a new book. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you on Monday.